Dr. Solomon is a professor of history emeritus at Simmons College in Boston. He holds degrees from Wayne State University, the University of Michigan, and Harvard University, where he received a PhD in history of American civilization. Professor Solomon has lectured widely in Europe, Asia, and the Caribbean, as well as the United States, on subjects ranging from U.S. foreign policy, the peace and civil rights movements, and the historic relationship between white radicals and African Americans. He has written or contributed to 6 books, including The Cry Was Unity, Communism and African Americans, 1917-1936. His latest book, which he edited and for which he wrote an extended afterword, is Crossing the River, Life in the American Left, the Cold War and East Germany, by Victor Grossman. That book will be published in September 2003. We'll have it here next year. Professor Solomon is also a longtime activist in the movements for peace and change. So give a warm welcome to Professor Mark Solomon.
Never in recent history has the threat of war by the United States upon another country been so unjust and so heavily constructed upon layers of falsehood. Let us look now for a moment at the given reasons. Reason number one, Iraq must disarm. Iraq has weapons of mass destruction which threaten the region and threaten the world. Ironic in light of the fact, of course, that Washington is poised to drop megatonnage upon that particular region of the world, which exceeds anything that has been dropped there in all known history. Well, okay, I would argue that, first of all, it is not about weapons of mass destruction. First of all, let's go back into a little recent history. The key element is a paper in 1997, a letter, actually, to Bill Clinton, produced by an outfit called the Project for a New Century, which some of you might have heard of. That grouping that was called together, largely by some of the main characters today, Rumsfeld and Cheney in particular, that group lobbied Clinton for what they called the overthrow of the Saddam Hussein regime. That is, regime change in Iraq. There was no discussion then of weapons of mass destruction. It was simply a matter of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. That group was constituted of people who are now honeycombed throughout the Bush administration. John Bolton, Richard Armitage, Paul Wolfowitz, Elliot Abrams, Iran-Contra convicted criminal, Richard Pearl, Zalmay Khalizi, someone who some of you may have heard of, top White House operative, native Afghani, representative of Unocal, the oil oligopoly that was in the process of attempting to cut a deal with the Taliban to build pipelines through Afghanistan. And when the Taliban resisted, the war broke out in Afghanistan. Khalizi is now one of the main Bush operatives in the Middle East and was also part of the Project for the New American Century. Interesting title, right? Weapons of mass destruction was an afterthought when the notion of regime change simply wasn't malleable, was meeting stiff resistance. As a matter of fact, it was regime change that was the purpose of a secret, what they call finding or memo, executive finding, ordered by Bush on September 14, 2001, 7 days after the disaster at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And that was done, of course, without a trace of evidence that Iraq particularly had anything to do with the horrible events of September 11th. As a matter of fact, it's interesting, and this is one of the problems that we have, seen it in my own family, that many people believe that the attackers at the World Trade Center were Iraqis, when there was not a single Iraqi involved, nowhere near there, that actually 16, excuse me, out of the 19 were from our firm, warm ally, the country of our firm ally, Saudi Arabia. This is known. Well, okay. While the White House then prattles about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, its fallback position, that country has been debilitated by a decade of sanctions, which have caused hundreds of thousands of deaths. Its weapons stocks heavily depleted by UN inspections. People don't realize that the UN inspections that took place up until 1998 had actually found and destroyed large stocks of chemical and biological weapons left over from the earlier period. As a matter of fact, one of the standard falsehoods that are repeated endlessly in the media is that in 1998, the Iraqis ordered the inspectors out of their country, when in fact, Clinton and the Clinton administration ordered the inspectors out because they were beginning to commence the bombing of forward positions of the Iraqi military forces. So, its defenses then, Iraq's defenses, on top of the effect of the debilitation from weapons inspections, were pulverized by these illegal US-British bombings, which, by the way, never had UN sanction. Iraq's internal landscape is now fractured by divisions so great that Saddam Hussein cannot control much of his own country, much less credibly threaten the largest and most lethal military power in history. Even, and let's take worst case, if Iraq sought nuclear weapons or a biochemical stockpile, which of course are possessed by other countries, the largest biochemical and nuclear weapons stockpile, of course, is held by the United States of America, which encouraged the group of Canadians to bring an inspection team to the United States to try to seek out the places where the US biological and chemical weapons are stored. But the slightest hint by Iraq of any aggressive move would unquestionably bring retribution too horrible to contemplate. Thus Iraq, no matter its motives or its leadership, is incapable of launching an aggressive war. If I may digress for a moment, to give you a sense of how fractured that country is, US special forces are already in Iraq, and they're in northern Iraq in areas controlled by right-wing Kurds who are in alliance with Washington. And that gives you some sense, really, of the degree of control that Saddam Hussein has on his own country. In addition, of course, there's a human dimension that we have to stop and look at. Reports from Iraq are coming out more and more, and some of you might have seen this week. You may recall Dr. Charles Clements, the famous Doctor Without War, which there was a great documentary done on him years ago. He's a former Air Force officer with a strong military background, who also happens to be a physician, who played a very important role in exposing the terrible conditions and circumstances that people in Central America were confronted with during the dirty wars in Nicaragua and El Salvador in the 1970s and 80s. Clements has spent a couple of weeks in Iraq, and he comes back, first of all, verifying that UNICEF statistics that during the period of sanctions, 500,000 Iraqi children have died as a result of sanctions which have choked off access to medical help to deal with various diseases that are now afflicting that country in very, very large degree. Clements reports this week that children are dying in huge numbers, that malnutrition is widespread, that in a country, as Senator Robert Byrd of Virginia pointed out, half the population of Iraq is 15 years old or younger. Half the population. And Byrd, who is getting on in years but still maintains a very powerful eloquence, said on the floor of the Senate the other day, "We are prepared to launch a murderous war against children," essentially, of a very, very young society. This is a society, by the way, according to Clemens, where 60% of the population is dependent upon the government for food, and the food allowances are very, very minimal, below minimal standards, that unemployment is now at 50%, that hospitals are filled with malnourished children, that doctors are telling parents of children who have contracted serious diseases that it would be kinder to shoot them than to let them linger. That is an actual quote from Clemens. And Clemens points out that even miraculously, if the dropping of 800 large laser-guided bombs within a two-day period, which is the stated military strategy of the United States and Britain, and nobody else actually, that even if miraculously that were to spare the civilian population, which of course is absurd on the face of it, nevertheless the disruption of water supplies, which already are contaminated, the breakdown of power grids, which would prevent, among other things, the transmission of information, the destruction of roads, would wipe out the minimal amount of aid getting to people as a result of the UN's Oil for Food and Medicine program. So that, to the extent at an emotional and moral level we feel an impending disaster, we have to do what one man in Boston said the other day who just returned from Iraq. You must look beyond that murderous dictator who was once a good U.S. ally, Saddam Hussein. Look beyond him and see the people. And if you see the people in a long, enduring culture, you must do everything you can to possibly stop this war. The fact of the matter is, then, to conclude this point, that the United States is willing to bomb and to go to war against Iraq because Iraq is weak, not strong. The People's Republic of North Korea, the Democrat DPRK, North Korea. People say Kim Jong-il is crazy. Well, maybe he's got the madman theory that he picked up from Richard Nixon. Remember that? Think of me as a madman and you'll respect me. Well, whatever the case, the approach of the United States to North Korea, which is more capable of defending itself, is quite different than toward Iraq. So you have here the Washington screams about weapons of mass destruction when the simple fact is it's because Iraq does not constitute a threat that the bullying, the threatening, and the obsessive compulsion to go to war is more manifest. But nevertheless, you come back to the question then, what is this all about? Well, first of all, we have to go back not only to the result of the war, the first Gulf War in 1991, but I say with an enormous degree of sadness, which I find people more and more beginning to understand, that the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the socialist bloc of nations in Eastern Europe, whatever one thinks of the internal development of those societies and their incredible weaknesses and distortions, the collapse of those societies, the breakup of a so-called bipolar world, the breakup of a world in which there was a balance of nuclear forces which brought a great degree of stability compared to the present, that breakup of the Soviet Union was an absolutely unmitigated disaster, a catastrophe, because what we're seeing going on in the world today simply could not go on in the same dimension had the world relationship of forces, if you'll allow me to use that term, had that world relationship of forces continued to exist. So therefore, you have a situation where a very distinct group has taken power in this country, a group that actually does not necessarily, and this is a source of hope, I think, represent the rational interest of a rational ruling class that does not necessarily want to see the world destroyed. This is a group that goes largely against the interest of its own social class. It is a group from extractive industries, oil and energy. It represents some of the most corrupt and corruptible elements of monopoly capital today. The Bechtel Corporation, which stands to make billions, supposedly, in the reconstruction of Iraq. Harkin Oil, where Bush has a direct relationship. Halliburton, Chevron, where Condoleezza Rice is a member of the board of directors. Enron, WorldCom, you name them. Companies that have become symbols of unmitigated corruption in recent years. There was a usurpation of power here, much of which, of course, was played out in this very part of the country where we stand today, where you had essentially an electoral coup d'etat, and you have a group of people, a sliver of a ruling elite in this country that represents largely extractive oil, geographically, to some extent, representing so-called Sun Belt and Southwest economic and political and strategic interest. What are they seeking to do? And this is really amazing. Michael Clare, one of the experts on issues of peace and resources, said to me just a week or so ago, I don't necessarily agree with him, but he said, no, everybody says this man Bush is stupid. He is not stupid. And you could probably say, whether it's Bush personally or whatever, not to get into ad hominem attacks here, because I think that would miss the point. But you could say that they've done something that is truly remarkable. That is, they've combined what you could call hegemonism. That is, the notion of a single state power to control the global economy, including control over regional and political centers of economic power, particularly the European Union, Japan, and China. So in other words, their view of globalization is largely focused upon the US setting the agenda. We've talked about this before, and I won't pursue it. A key element, of course, of this hegemonism over the global economy is unchallenged military control over the Middle East and the Caspian Sea region, assuring, among other things, massive leverage through control of oil over others who might, and this is written, this is not anybody's imagination, this is in Cheney's national security directives that go back to January 1993 when he left office, having been Secretary of Defense at the time, saying that what we have to do in this post-Soviet world is create a power for the United States that can not only resist but crush any challenge to our position. And oil becomes a significant factor in that regard. Another element, of course, is to maintain, even as the United States asserts its dominance over the world system, it helps to strengthen globalization. You won't find, to this point, any major dispute with Bush on the part of the big global players, because Bush has pursued the World Trade Organization, the IMF, NAFTA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, all of which satisfy the requirements of the main centers of globalization. But then a contradiction arises. They need a political base within the country to maintain themselves in power. So they are hegemonist, they are globalist, and they're also ultra-right-wing, ultra-nationalist, racist, anti-Semitic, you name it. Even though there are a significant number of Jews within this grouping, the anti-Semitism nevertheless is manifest. And what is the political base? Christian fundamentalism, ultranationalism, supply-side economics, tax cuts for the rich, if you will, an economic right wing, racists who attack affirmative action and who make war upon the poor. An essential and frightening feature is that they will ultimately, as I said, pursue their own vision of U.S. domination in a globalized world economy without caring about the overall interests of their own particular class. Okay, according to reliable leaked documents, and absolute credibility is established by none other than Senator Ted Kennedy, who has played an outstanding role in this current situation. And that has shown that these guys have gone to the extent of saying, and this is truly frightening and truly legitimizes and justifies moving every muscle that we have to try to put it, to challenge this, to protest, to put a stop to it. That is, Bush has authorized the use of nuclear weapons, presumably in response to the use of chemical weapons. However, Washington's military strategists, the Pentagon strategists, are already assuming that Hussein and his acolytes will go into deep bunkers, and that deep bunkers will characterize the resistance in Iraq, and tactical nuclear weapons will have to be used to take out those deep bunkers. And as Kennedy pointed out in innumerable remarks, including a very important op-ed piece in the Boston Globe about a week ago, that Bush is threatening to cross the threshold, the fatal threshold between conventional and nuclear weapons. And once that threshold is crossed, the threat to humanity as a whole is escalated qualitatively, about the most moderate thing I could say on that particular question. As a matter of fact, we're in a bizarre situation in a sense, in that Iraq is accused of repeatedly violating UN resolutions, especially Resolution 1441, while Washington is poised to violate not UN Resolution 1441, but the UN Charter itself and the fundamental standard of civilization. You do not wage aggressive war upon those who have done nothing to you. And that particular concept is being steadily, dramatically, quickly eroded and undermined by the Bush administration. As a matter of fact, again, going back to the national security strategy document, which according to law, the Secretary of Defense must issue at the end of a calendar year. And it was, as I said before, in January 1993, where Secretary of Defense at the time, Dick Cheney, said, the U.S. has the power to act preemptively and alone if others are unwilling to follow. That the United States must establish, the words were unambiguous, military predominance over the whole world, including the right, reserving the right to preemptive attacks and a general concept of unilateralism. And it was back in 1993 even that the hint was thrown out, if not the flat out declaration, that the United States should be poised to engage in first use of nuclear weapons. No wonder the world looks on in terror. Okay then. If it's not about weapons of mass destruction, if it's more about regime change, What about inspections? Well, it's not about inspections, of course. The inspections were basically a political concession that was forced upon the Bush administration by its own allies, even its little, you know, lapdog acolyte Great Britain. But it's something that Washington, of course, has absolutely no use for, despite the fact, of course, that there is no separation between process and substance. When a process finds an empty shell and removes the shell, when a process finds that a truck is not a biochemical weapons truck but a food truck, that process is substance, and that process means that there is no threat of weapons of mass destruction, and that the whole world recognizes inspections are working.